Welcome to the Age of Napoleon. Dispatch 10. As always, if you're listening to this, thank you for your support. I couldn't do this without you. I thought we'd start this installment with another passage on the Battle of Eylau. This was written by a young Russian light cavalry officer named Denis Davidov. Davidov is an interesting character. He was probably most famous for his war poetry. He was one of the most widely read Russian poets of this era. His writing celebrated the hard-living ethos of the Hussar regiments, drinking, smoking, gambling, womanizing, and witty conversation off the battlefield, combined with daring and adventure on the battlefield. But beyond his poetry, Davidov's military career is notable in its own right. Later in the Napoleonic Wars, he led a series of large cavalry raids deep behind enemy lines that were very successful. A lot of military historians consider him one of the forerunners of modern partisan warfare. On top of all that, he was a character. He had a very lively and gregarious personality that really shows through in his writings. Those of you who are familiar with Tolstoy's War and Peace, or have watched one of the TV or film adaptations, might remember the character of Denisov, who was based on Denis Davidov. The Eylau campaign was Davidov's first real taste of the Napoleonic Wars. He actually had to go to army headquarters and beg to be assigned to the army in Poland. In his memoirs, he compares Eylau to the Battle of Borodino, which we will of course be covering in the future. Quote, "The Battle of Eylau has almost receded from contemporary memory after the storm of the Battle of Borodino, and because many now feel that it was not an equally significant event. For a Russian, the issue that was debated by force of arms at Borodino was far nobler, more involving, and more passionate than the contest at Eylau, because what was at stake was Russia's very survival. The object of dispute at Eylau was on a very different level. True, it proved to be a bloody prelude to Napoleon's invasion of Russia, but no one could have foreseen this. It appeared, rather, as a contest of military prestige by both armies, in the spirit, say, of card players, fighting it out with their wallets still crammed, not obliged to wager their last morsel of bread, or contemplate shooting themselves in the head in the event they lost. It is not really fair to compare the two battles on the basis of the number of combatants or casualties. This is because, at Eylau, different weapons and fighting methods prevailed. At the Battle of Borodino, the main weapon was firepower. At Eylau, it was hand-to-hand fighting that took center stage. Bayonet and sword held sway, drinking their fill of blood. No other battle had witnessed clashes of infantry and cavalry and exchanges of musket fire on such a scale, and cannon bombardment merely played a supporting role there. As in other battles, the guns produced more noise than destruction, and made a greater impression on the minds and morale of the troops, speeding up the destruction of the enemy by other means. I was only about 20 years old, full of verve, looking forward to any kind of adventure, and eager to confront every sort of danger. I must have been immune to the rain of cannonballs that hummed overhead, crashed around me, and plowed through the ranks by my side, or the hail of explosives that burst above my head and under my feet." End quote. Davidov then goes on to describe the disposition of the two armies in great detail, and some of the early action of the battle, of which he had no direct knowledge. So I'll pick up again with his description of Murat's charge. Quote, "It was a critical moment. Napoleon, whose resolve increased in proportion to present dangers, ordered Murat and Bessières to strike at our troops as they charged forward with shouts of Hurrah. This action was essential to save even a part of Augereau's corps and to head off our attack. More than 60 squadrons galloped forward to the right of the fleeing corps and swept towards us, brandishing their swords. The field resounded with their cries, and the snow plowed up by a concerted force of 12,000 riders swirled up in a tempest. The brilliant Murat, sporting his carnival-style uniform, and followed by a large entourage, led the attack with bare saber, and plunged directly into the thick of battle. Neither musket and cannon fire, nor leveled bayonets, could stem the deadly tide. The French cavalry smashed its way through the front line of our army, and its impetuous charge even reached our second line, and the reserve. Here, however, it shattered against the cliff of a stronger will. Our men stood their ground, did not waver, and turned back the awesome tidal wave with concerted artillery and musket fire. End quote. So, as you can see, a bit of a different perspective there. Davidov was a patriot, and obviously preferred to emphasize his countrymen's resistance to the charge, rather than the damage it did to the coalition army. Davidov would later say that the piece of writing he was most proud of was his description of Eylau, and the whole thing is worth reading. His memoirs can be found relatively cheap. They are called In the Service of the Tsar Against Napoleon, and are very easy to find online. Anyway, on to your questions. First, Henry Hausman asked, any favorite pieces of Napoleonic-inspired fiction, either historical fiction like Master and Commander, or Napoleonic-inspired fantasy like Temeraire or Powdermage? As I've discussed in past episodes, I'm a big fan of the Sharp series, both the novels by Bernard Cornwell and the British TV series of the same name, starring Sean Bean. I think it's been at least 10 years since I read one, but I remember them being a lot of fun, and surprisingly accurate for what they are. I'm also a big fan of the film version of Master and Commander, starring Russell Crowe and directed by Peter Weir. I have not really delved into the novels by Patrick O'Brien, but I know they're very well regarded, and a lot of you enjoy them. I know I've also mentioned the film The Duelists, directed by Ridley Scott, and starring Keith Carradine and Harvey Keitel. That's been one of my favorite movies since long before I started this show. The only Napoleonic-inspired fantasy I've ever read is Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell by Susanna Clarke. I don't typically read fantasy, but I really enjoyed this. I don't want to spoil too much, but the fantasy elements are really allegories for all the social and technological changes of this period. I thought it was a very imaginative and perceptive book, and I would recommend it to anyone interested in this era of history, even if you are not usually a fan of fantasy. Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell was also adapted into a miniseries of the same name by the BBC, which I thought was very good as well. Next, Frank Gaunt asked, I remember reading as a kid that Napoleon looked up to figures from antiquity, Julius Caesar and Alexander, if I recall correctly. How much did this interest impact Napoleon? And, if not too broad a question, what was classical studies like during the Napoleonic period versus today? Yes, you're quite right. Napoleon idolized the great men of history from an early age, especially figures from classical times, and Caesar and Alexander were two of his favorites. I'll talk about this more in future episodes, but he really did look to the ancients as a model. Historians debate how significant this actually was, some arguing he really was trying to recreate certain aspects of the old Roman Empire, others that he was basically just putting a classical facade over certain reforms that he wanted to carry out, as a way of selling them to a public that was going through a mania for classical history. I once saw a very interesting line, which stuck with me, even though I have unfortunately forgotten who wrote it, that Napoleon was the first postmodern dictator, meaning that he was not simply acting in response to the political conditions of the moment, but he was actually self-conscious of himself as a great historical figure, who would one day have a legacy comparable to the great leaders of the past, and be studied and judged accordingly. In the back of his mind, he always had the idea that someday, long after his death, children would be reading about him in the same way he had once read about Caesar and Alexander. I think this is a good insight, and it adds an interesting layer to every one of Napoleon's decisions. As to the second part of your question, classical studies as we know them had just barely entered their infancy in this period. That might seem a bit strange, given that across the whole Western world, the educated classes were in a mania for all things Greek and Roman. But mania does not necessarily imply scholarly rigor. A lot of the information about the ancients that was floating around during this period was not much more than legends and romanticized half-truths. You might compare it to fan fiction today. In our world, classical studies is an academic discipline. They employ rational inquiry and the scientific method. There were people in the Napoleonic era who took a more rigorous and scholarly approach to studying the ancients. A great example is someone we met during our episodes on Horatio Nelson, Sir William Hamilton, husband of Nelson's great love, Lady Emma Hamilton. Sir William had a huge collection of classical art and artifacts, which he tried to analyze and categorize with something approaching a modern scholarly attitude. He even sponsored expeditions to go look for more artifacts, making him a very early pioneer in the field of archaeology. But Sir William's scientific outlook was somewhat exceptional. Most classical history enthusiasts of this period approached the topic more like a series of legends about their great illustrious ancestors, and as legends often do, they got a lot of the facts wrong. For instance, in France, it was very common for ethnic or regional subgroups to explain their origins as members of one of Caesar's lost legions. If a town or a village somewhere in the former Roman Empire had old ruins nearby, they were usually explained as having been built by Caesar, no matter when they were actually constructed, and even if they were obviously non-Roman. To take one example I've always found interesting, Corsicans of this period seem to have been almost universally convinced that their island's unique political and social traditions, including the clan system and the vendetta, were holdovers from their ancient Roman ancestors, that Corsica was the last place in Europe where the old liberties of Republican Rome were still maintained and respected. Consensus among modern historians is that this is totally wrong, that the Romans, in fact, had very little impact on Corsica. They were just another of the outside foreign powers who have dominated the island during its history, but not really left much of a mark on it. To the extent that modern Corsicans are the descendants of the ancient Romans, it is probably more from the large number of people who emigrated to the island from Italy during the Middle Ages. Any similarities between the Corsican clan system and ancient Roman society are mostly superficial. There are always commonalities between social and political systems in which clan and family play a large role. So to sum up, for a lot of Europeans of this era, their interest in classical Greece and Rome only had a passing resemblance to classical studies as we know them. In many ways, this was more of a cultural trend than an intellectual one, maybe closer to Star Wars mania than a serious scholarly movement. Next, Jacob Knapp asked, was there such a thing as a war correspondent or embedded journalism in this era? How did news of the campaign get back home? The modern war correspondent really came into being in the mid-19th century, when the telegraph enabled journalists at the front to get reports back home within days of the action. In Europe, the Crimean War, which began in 1853, was the first conflict to be covered with something approaching modern journalistic methods. In North America, it was the American Civil War, which started in 1861. There was a person from the Napoleonic Wars who might be considered as a sort of proto-war correspondent, the British writer Henry Crabb Robinson, who worked for the Times of London in Spain during the Peninsular War. However, I think modern war correspondents would probably consider Robinson's methods pretty amateurish, and maybe a little cowardly. He never got remotely close to combat, but basically just gathered rumors and secondhand reports to send back to London. So how did news get from the front into the papers? One common avenue was letters home by the participants. After a big battle or campaign, officers, and soldiers if they were literate, would almost always try to get word back to their families that they were all right, and sometimes to brag about their achievements. These letters often included general information about events at the front, and if they were particularly informative, their families would forward them to the newspapers, or sell them to professional pamphleteers, who then reprinted them. There might also be letters from civilians who happened to be nearby or had some special knowledge of events. For instance, a businessman working in a major city near the battle, or a member of the embassy staff in the country where it took place, might use their contacts to get information on a battle, then write a letter home with all they learned, with the intention of informing the wider public. And newspapermen of this era were not above simply printing rumors and gossip. They were sometimes quite frank about this. You can find contemporary articles that start with lines like, "Rumors have reached us." These sources of information could be useful, but they had obvious inherent limits. The quote-unquote reporters were amateurs with no training or professional ethics to guide them. They were often unreliable. For example, as we saw in the episode on the aftermath of the Battle of Austerlitz, that engagement was reported as a great coalition victory in the British papers for over a month. Often, both newspapers and the wider public were forced to rely on official government reports. Most governments of this era had their own newspapers, although these were not really newspapers in the modern sense, more records of the regime's official pronouncements and activities, akin to a modern press briefing. Probably the most famous of these were the Moniteur Universel, published in Paris, which I have quoted from in past episodes, and the London Gazette, which contained the official line of the British government. With little official war journalism going on, people often had little to go on but whatever the governments of the two sides said. Newspaper accounts of battles in this period are sometimes doing little more than trying to evaluate these official stories based on gut instinct. So, war journalism was pretty rudimentary during this period, really just a patchwork of unreliable amateur reporting and official government propaganda. I'll leave it to you to judge how much things have changed. Next, Alistair Forrest asked, "Is there any particular role in the Grande Armée that you would feel particularly suited for or would want to do?" Well, given that I'm roughly the same size as General Jean-Joseph de Poul, I know how to ride a horse, and I used to fence, I assume they would have put me in the heavy cavalry, which, to be honest, sounds like a nightmare. I'm not sure I have it in me to charge right into a formation of enemy infantry, and I doubt all that armor is very good for your back. Mostly, I'm just grateful I've never had to put up with anything approaching the level of hardship these men dealt with on a near-daily basis. The comradeship and champagne and cool uniforms and hordes of curious young female civilians do sound like fun, but I'll take indoor plumbing and modern medicine any day. Next, Ola asked, "As one of your loyal listeners from Sweden, I have to ask if at this point you do not feel hesitated to discuss Sweden's place in this conflict. I know that you have said that you would not focus on it, which of course I respect and fully get. Still, from now until 1809 is one of the most dramatic episodes in Swedish history, with plenty of rich characters and dramatic turns. I'm sure all of your Swedish listeners would love a bonus episode on the Finnish War, or what happened in Swedish Pomerania. I promise you I have not forgotten about your country. I have an episode, or more likely two or three episodes, planned for the future, covering Marshal Bernadotte's unlikely path to the crown of Sweden. As you may have noticed by now, I don't really like doing straight biography episodes. They always feel a bit simplistic to me. So, when we covered Nelson, we spent a lot of time talking about the Royal Navy in general, as an institution. When I covered Toussaint Louverture, we spent a lot of time talking about the history of Haiti and the story of their revolution. And of course, this whole show is in part a biography of Napoleon, and it includes all kinds of context and digressions. So I've been avoiding talking too much about what was going on in Scandinavia at this time because I want to save that material for the future Bernadotte episodes. For those of you who aren't aware, Sweden was a major player in European affairs in the 17th and 18th century. By the dawn of the French Revolution, it had declined a bit since that golden age, but it was still on that second tier, just below the five great powers. As you alluded to in your question, this was a very eventful period in Swedish history, and I do plan on covering as much of it as I can, but you will have to be patient and wait just a little longer until we get to those Bernadotte episodes. Next, Harvey Duncliffe asked, "I've always wondered which French regiment was most feared by the coalition forces. I am aware of the fame of the Imperial Guard, specifically the Grenadiers of the Old Guard, but I was wondering if there were any other lesser-known regiments with similar or better battle records. And do you have a favorite regiment that you find interesting?" First of all, for reasons that are probably obvious, most feared is very hard to measure in any kind of systematic or scientific way. With that said, based on what I've read, the most feared units in every army were cavalry. This makes sense to me. As we've seen in past episodes, especially the last one, under the right conditions, cavalry could appear out of nowhere and completely annihilate enemy infantry. And that feeling of trying to run from men on horseback, knowing that at any moment the saber blow or pistol shot that kills you could be coming in from behind must have been completely terrifying. In a previous dispatch, I've mentioned the book Tactics and the Experience of Battle in the Age of Napoleon by Rory Muir, which is a great book. I'll go ahead and recommend it again. In it, he quotes from a British officer who said Lancers were the most feared type of cavalry in the French army. I'd imagine for the simple reason that it's harder to imagine yourself surviving being impaled by a lance than cut by a saber. If that officer was right, the best candidates for most feared regiment in the French army would probably be the 1st Light Cavalry Lancer Regiment of the Imperial Guard, commonly known as the Polish Lancers because they were recruited from Poland, or the 2nd Light Cavalry Lancer Regiment of the Imperial Guard, commonly known as the Red Lancers, because, you guessed it, they wore red. The Red Lancers were originally made up of Dutchmen, although as the regiment suffered casualties and attrition, they were often replaced with Frenchmen. Still, it is interesting that perhaps the most feared units in the French army were not made up of Frenchmen. I've also read accounts that talked about how enemy soldiers feared the mounted carbineers. You might remember from our episode on the cavalry that the mounted carbineers were 2 regiments of elite heavy cavalry. They were armed with heavy straight swords, rode big powerful horses, and wore distinctive uniforms, all white with gold-plated body armor and bright red plumes in their helmets. I'm sure this very easy-to-spot uniform contributed to their reputation. Apparently, the carbineers were some of the few French units feared by the Russian Cossacks. This was an elite unit with elite riding skills and much heavier-duty equipment than the Cossacks ever carried. If a force of carbineers and a force of Cossacks met on more or less equal terms, it was likely to be a deadly encounter for the Russians. As to the second part of your question of favorite regiments, I always keep an eye out for the 3rd Hussar Regiment, which is the unit of Armand Dubert, the fictional protagonist of the movie The Duelists. I've also always been interested in the Irish Legion. I'm sure some of that is the fact that my own ancestors came from Ireland, but I think it is inherently interesting that there was a relatively prominent body of men from the English-speaking world who fought for Napoleon. When you think of the Grande Armée, you don't imagine its soldiers being led by officers with names like Arthur O'Connor, William Lawless, or Miles Byrne, but they were there too. Lawless and Byrne were even awarded the Legion of Honor. A lot of the common soldiers in the Irish Legion only had tenuous connections to Ireland. Many had been born, or at least raised, in France. Some only had Irish grandparents. And some had no connection at all. But they wore green jackets, fought under a green flag, and wore a harp symbol on their uniforms. Part of the reason this unit survived for so long, despite the difficulty in finding new recruits, was that it had a powerful benefactor, Napoleon's Minister of War, Henri-Jacques Guillaume Clark. As you might have guessed from the name, Clark had Irish roots. His parents came from Kilkenny, although he was born and raised in France. Although he was good at his job, Clark was not well-liked, simply because it sounds like he was a bit of a bore, always going off on long monologues, which tended to be about himself. Apparently, one of his favorite subjects for these annoying soliloquies was his Irish roots and the role his family had played in Irish history. I've always found this very funny because, as someone who grew up around a lot of Irish Americans, I know exactly what it's like to sit through that monologue. You wouldn't think Napoleon's Minister of War would have the same annoying affectation as my friend's dad, but apparently he did. That's all for now. I'm still trying to decide what exactly to include in the next episode, so I'll be back to you in a few weeks, but I'm not sure with what. As always, thanks for your support, and thanks for listening.